The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they pride themselves on providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. And we are reading this today from the January 24th, 2020 issue of The Week magazine. Our cover drawing this week shows in the background Buckingham Palace and the gate, and a couple of the royal guards are running toward the foreground. And in the foreground, we see two holes being dug up through the asphalt, and coming out of those with shovels in their hand are Prince Harry and Meghan Markle. The title of this week's cover drawing is A Royal Escape. What drove Meghan and Harry to flee the House of Windsor? And I believe that's our controversy of the week, but we will start with the two main stories. They're a little shorter than usual. We'll get both of them. Checking Trump's war powers, what happened? Congress moved this week to curtail President Trump's ability to attack Iran without a formal declaration of war, as the administration continued to give shifting stories for why it ordered a drone strike that killed a top Iranian general and brought the U.S. and Iran to the brink of armed conflict. Senator Tim Kaine said he'd mustered the four Republican votes Democrats need to pass a resolution requiring Trump to obtain congressional approval before ordering more strikes against Iran, unless an attack is imminent. Earlier, the House voted 224 to 194, with the backing of three Republicans, to pass a non-binding resolution to much the same effect. Kaine, who has the support of Senator Susan Collins, Republican from Maine, Todd C. Young, Republican from Indiana, and Mike Lee, the Republican from Utah, and Rand Paul, Republican from Kentucky, said a vote could take place as early as next week. The House would then vote again on the Senate version before it goes to Trump, who's expected to veto it. Over the past week, the administration gave several differing justifications for the January 3rd killing of Major General Qassem Soleimani, who was regarded as Iran's second most powerful person. President Trump said on Fox News that Soleimani was plotting an attack on four U.S. embassies. But Secretary of Defense Mark Esper said he never saw intelligence with regard to four embassies. NBC News reported Trump actually approved a strike on Soleimani 7 months ago, but only if Iran killed an American. The dispute came to a boil at a congressional intelligence briefing, during which administration officials told senators that questioning Trump's authority to use force against Iran would only embolden America's enemies. Lee, a Republican, called the briefing insulting and demeaning and the worst he'd ever witnessed. What the editorial said. Let's hope the House and Senate's actions are just the start of Congress reasserting its war power, said the Washington Post. For decades, Congress has abdicated its constitutional responsibility over matters of war, letting presidents of both parties launch military attacks without clear authorization. That enabled members of Congress to avoid responsibility for the consequences of any military action. But as the near catastrophe with Iran demonstrated, Congress must now establish clearer limitations on the unilateral presidential use of force. Democrats raised no such concerns when President Obama ordered 500-plus drone strikes that killed thousands in a half-dozen countries, said the New York Post. The new war powers legislation is a stunt by Congress, which is fuming that Trump didn't inform leaders of the Soleimani strike in advance. But it's pointless to hamstring the president in future dealings with Iran, which poses a real ongoing threat. What the columnist said. Trump's claim of an imminent threat against four embassies might be his worst lie, said Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. The real reason Trump nearly started a war was that he feared that the recent storming by pro-Iranian militias of the U.S. embassy in Baghdad would be equated to Benghazi, a totemic conservative symbol of Obama's supposed weakness. Clearly, Congress needs to restrain an impulsive and dishonest president. The hysteria over Trump nearly launching another endless war is totally unfounded, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. The president is no conventional interventionist or isolationist, but instead a devotee of a philosophy with historical roots dating to President Andrew Jackson. In this worldview, America is content to let the world sort itself out, except if it harms Americans. If the bad guys cross that red line, as an Iran-backed militia did when it killed an American contractor in Iraq in December, the president will react with great ferocity. But he didn't start a war. In Trump's worldview, he's a near king who can do whatever he pleases, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com. How else to interpret the intelligence briefing in which, in Lee's words, Esper essentially told 97 senators to be good little boys and girls and not question Trump's decisions? With open contempt, Trump and his team scoff and smirk at Congress and the press and refuse to accept any limitations on their power. Trump's White House continues its march toward authoritarian rule. In a second main story, new Ukraine evidence as impeachment moves to Senate. What happened? House Democrats voted to send articles of impeachment against President Trump to the Senate this week, hours after releasing damaging new evidence of Trump's alleged scheme to pressure Ukraine into investigating Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi named seven managers to present the prosecution, led by House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff. Pelosi withheld the articles approved by her chamber, abuse of power and obstruction of Congress, for a month to pressure Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to include new witnesses in the trial, which is expected to begin next week. McConnell refused to make any pledge, but several moderate Republican senators signaled support for calling witnesses. A morning consult poll found that 57% of voters want the Senate to hear additional witnesses. Calls for further testimony grew after the House released a tranche of notes, text messages, and other records from Lev Parnas, the businessman who served as a fixer in Ukraine for Rudy Giuliani, Trump's personal attorney. In one March exchange, a top Ukrainian prosecutor links his efforts to find dirt on Biden and his son Hunter, who once sat on the board of a Ukrainian gas company, to the removal of then U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch. She was recalled a month later. Other texts sent to Parnas, who is under federal indictment, indicate Yovanovitch was being tailed by Robert Hyde, now a GOP congressional candidate. Hyde wrote that unidentified security forces might help remove Yovanovitch, adding, "Guess you can do anything in the Ukraine with money." What the columnist said. Pelosi got outplayed, said Matthew Continetti in NationalReview.com. She took the wind out of impeachment sails with her four-week delay, thinking she could strong-arm McConnell into accepting her rules for his trial. Pelosi's leverage was non-existent, of course, since the Senate Majority Leader rightly claimed to be following bipartisan rules set ahead of President Bill Clinton's trial. And if Pelosi held out indefinitely, fine with McConnell, who had other important business to attend to. Eventually, Senate Democrats told Pelosi to get on with it. The Parnas documents have blown up Trump's alibi, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. His defense was going to hinge on the claim that when he asked Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in a phone call to do us a favor, he meant the U.S., not his private interest. Yet Parnas has coughed up a letter from Giuliani to Zelensky asking for a meeting with Trump's knowledge and consent. It's a written confession of the president abusing his power. Too bad the Senate will put on a show trial, said Quinta Jurecic and Benjamin Witz in the Atlantic.com. From Chief Justice John Roberts presiding to the House managers making their case, we're in for a lot of pageantry and little suspense. Most senators have already declared their voting intentions, and there's no chance 20 Senate Republicans will defect and declare Trump guilty. The third ever impeachment trial will be a historic event, but it's hard to feel much excitement when we know how the whole thing is going to end. Our controversy of the week is titled Megxit, Why Meghan and Harry Are Fleeing the Royals. She married a handsome prince in a fairy tale wedding, said Madeline Kearns in NationalReview.com. But evidently, actress Meghan Markle had her own ideas of what happily ever after should look like. Last week, the U.S.-born Duchess of Sussex and her husband, Prince Harry, stunned the world with the announcement that they intend, in their words, to step back as senior members of the royal family and carve out a progressive new role. Details of what the British tabloids quickly branded Megxit are vague, said Maureen Callahan in the New York Post. Even after a face-to-face meeting this week with the 93-year-old Queen Elizabeth, who is reportedly both livid and crushed. Both the Sussexes say they will relocate with their son to Canada and perhaps later to Los Angeles and will work to become financially independent. In other words, they expect the House of Windsor to keep funding their lavish lifestyle while they shirk the duties and the scrutiny that are the historic trade-off of royalty. It seems Meghan and Harry won't be happy until they're having their cake and eating it too. This was the right call for the Sussexes, said Andrew Pizer, also in the New York Post. Meghan, a new mother, has made it publicly clear she finds life inside the fishbowl unbearable. And Harry wants out, too. He saw the torments of royal life turn Diana, his mother, into a well-dressed eating disorder, and then literally kill her in a car crash fleeing paparazzi in Paris. As a black Briton, said Afua Hirsch in the New York Times, I am not surprised the press has succeeded in hounding Meghan out of Britain. The tabloids were against the biracial American actress from the start, playing up the contrast between the allegedly pushy Meghan and Kate, her dutiful sister-in-law. One tabloid headline described Meghan as almost straight out of Compton, and a BBC radio host compared their newborn son, Archie, to a chimpanzee. Meghan would never be accepted in a class-conscious country where there is still a deep correlation between privilege and race. Good for her and Harry for giving the British establishment the finger. It would have been even more subversive for them to stay, said Maureen Dowd, also in the New York Times. From the gospel choir at their wedding to her public stands on women's rights and climate change, Meghan brought a refreshing dose of semi-radical chic to the royal family. Rather than making a run for the Hollywood Hills, she should have stayed and wielded her wokeness where it is needed most. Meghan Markle has already made a difference, said Monica Hess in the Washington Post. For all its glamour, the princess fantasy of Western fairy tales has always been a vision of passivity and dependence. Markle, though, has just flipped the princess fantasy on its big crowned head, showing a generation of young women that you can have your handsome prince without giving up your own freedom and voice. The lessons for the royal family may be less uplifting, said Britain's Observer in an editorial. When the prince fell in love with a divorced actress with an African-American mother, it was a golden opportunity for the queen and her family to embrace a modern 21st century identity. But it clearly has not worked. Megxit may well come to be remembered as the beginning of the end for this ludicrously outdated institution. And we'll go into the Good Week, Bad Week segment. Seems it was a good week for Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the Democratic Socialist from New York, who raised $2 million in the last quarter of 2019 and now has $3 million cash on hand, more than almost any member of Congress. AOC is expected to easily win re-election and may be planning a future run for the Senate or the White House. It was a good week for liberals following the announcement that Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, 86, has returned to the bench after completing treatment for pancreatic cancer. "I'm cancer-free," she said. And finally, it was a good week for humble bragging after Burt Ward, who played Robin to Adam West's Batman in the campy 1960s TV series, claimed that network officials made him take penis-reducing pills to reduce a too-large bulge in his skin-tight costume. Ward, now 74, says he complied for 3 days, but then just used my cape to cover it. It was a bad week for alternative realities after the White House Twitter account released a picturesque photo of the official presidential home against a night sky full of snowflakes, beneath the caption, "First Snow of the Year." Temperatures in Washington, D.C. soared to 70 degrees that day and never got below a balmy 53. It was a bad week for cat owners after a new study found evidence that cats will eat human flesh, including its owner's corpse, if there's no other food. And finally, it was a bad week for the middle-aged, with new data indicating that 47.2 is the precise age at which the average person hits the low point of the lifelong happiness curve. Tom, 47.19, told Slate.com that suddenly the ticking of the clock grows that much louder. Also, hemorrhoids. And before we move on, a short news item. Seizing $7.2 billion to pay for the wall. President Trump is preparing to divert $7.2 billion in defense funding for border wall construction this year, five times what Congress authorized in the 2020 budget. The Washington Post reported this week, the money will again be repurposed for military construction projects and counter-narcotics initiatives. Dozens of Pentagon projects were halted last year, including the construction of schools on military bases, after the Trump administration reallocated $3.6 billion. Federal judges blocked that move, but last week the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals lifted the injunction, saying the county of El Paso, Texas, and an activist group likely lacked standing to challenge the diversion. Administration officials plan to build 885 miles of new fencing by spring of 2022. We're on the briefing page, title this week, Four Decades of Conflict. Iran and the U.S. have been enemies since 1979. Why? What is the state of relations? For four decades, the U.S. and Iran have been locked into what is essentially an ongoing low-grade war. Since its inception in 1979, the Shiite theocracy, now run by the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei and a council of top clerics, has considered the U.S. the Great Satan, an intruder in the Middle East and a primary obstacle to the mullah's goal of sustaining and spreading the Shiite Islamic revolution. Speeches and sermons often end with the chant, "Death to America." Iran sponsors a network of Shiite militias and parties in countries across the Middle East, including Hezbollah in Lebanon and the Badr organization in Iraq, and it's sworn to the destruction of key U.S. ally Israel. Over the years, Iranian-backed terrorists have attacked U.S. troops and killed hundreds of Americans. From Iran's point of view, the U.S. has sought to destroy its regime almost from its inception, surrounding it with military bases in Iraq, Afghanistan, Turkey, and the Gulf states, and crippling its economy through punishing sanctions. When did problems begin? It all started in 1953 under President Eisenhower when the CIA and British intelligence led a coup against elected Iranian Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, who had nationalized the Anglo-Iranian oil company. The Shah, modern reformer Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, was installed as head of state and restored British and U.S. access to oil. The Shah created a secret police force, SAVAK, to keep various leftist and religious opposition groups in check. But its authoritarian abuses further embittered Iranians who considered the Shah a puppet of the West. Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, a fundamentalist cleric who had been banished to France, inspired massive protests that forced the Shah to flee, enabling the Ayatollah to return and set up a theocratic government. When President Jimmy Carter allowed the ailing Shah to come to America for medical treatment, enraged Iranian students broke into the U.S. Embassy, taking 52 American diplomats hostage for a gut-wrenching 444 days. What happened under Reagan? The U.S. and the Iranian theocracy struggled, often violently, for influence in the region. In 1983, a Hezbollah truck bomb killed 241 Americans, mostly Marines, who were on a peacekeeping mission in Lebanon to support the Christian-led government. President Reagan then withdrew U.S. soldiers from Lebanon. Iraq's Saddam Hussein, meanwhile, launched a war against Iran that cost 500,000 lives, with the U.S. providing support to Iraq as the lesser of the two evils. Amid heightened tensions, the U.S. Navy mistakenly shot down an Iranian passenger jet in the Persian Gulf in 1988, killing all 290 people on board. It was during this period that Iran decided to develop nuclear weapons. How did the nuclear program start? Iran began working with Pakistan, China, and Russia to develop nuclear technology, insisting it would be used only for electrical generation. But in 2002, Iranian dissidents revealed that Iran had built a uranium enrichment plant at Natanz that could be used to help build a bomb. Over the ensuing years, Iran repeatedly evaded United Nations inspectors and lied about the extent of its activities. After the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003, largely to establish a pro-Western democracy in the region, Iran began supporting Iraq's Shiite militias, who killed hundreds of U.S. soldiers with improvised bombs. When President Barack Obama took office, he sought to broker a deal with Iran. In 2015, U.S. negotiators and Iranian President Hassan Rouhani, a relative moderate, reached an agreement to curtail Iran's nuclear program. What was in the nuclear deal? Iran agreed to slash the number of its uranium centrifuges, machines that can spin that element into a highly enriched form of usable in nuclear bombs, and submit to intrusive inspections in exchange for the lifting of sanctions and the release of some $50 billion in frozen Iranian assets held abroad. The deal, backed by the EU, Russia, and China, would have prevented Iran from enriching significant amounts of uranium until at least 2031. For 3 years, the UN and EU said that Iran was complying fully with the treaty. But many Republicans, including presidential candidate Donald Trump, objected that the restrictions on enrichment would expire after 15 years and complained that it did nothing to restrict Iran's support for terrorism abroad. What did President Trump do? Trump pulled the U.S. out of the pact in May of 2018 and reimposed devastating sanctions on Iran, including an embargo on Iranian oil. This policy of maximum pressure, the administration says, is intended to force Iran to negotiate a more comprehensive deal and agree to end all aggressive actions in the region. But with its economy deeply damaged, the Iranian regime became even more aggressive. It sabotaged several Western oil tankers, then shot down a U.S. drone, and in September, through its Houthi proxy in Yemen, Iran bombed two key oil installations in Saudi Arabia. In Iraq, Iranian-backed militias tried to storm the U.S. embassy in Baghdad. Trump responded by authorizing a drone strike that killed Qassem Soleimani, the powerful leader of the Quds force who oversaw Iran's network of allied militias. The killing of Soleimani, said Ali Baez, director of the Iran Program for the International Crisis Group, is the death knell of the Iran nuclear deal and any prospect of diplomacy between Iran and the U.S. Moving into the best columns of the week, we'll start with two from the U.S. First, how Twitter promotes leftist illusions. Does Twitter matter? Asked Helen Lewis. Although the social media site's base of 321 million active monthly users is tiny compared with Facebook's 2 billion, Twitter is closely monitored by journalists, celebrities, and partisan activists, and thus has outsized power to shape the political conversation. In both the UK and the US, Twitter is dominated by white, highly educated progressives who use the site to police public discourse for offenses against woke values and to demand that left-leaning parties adopt far-left positions that most voters do not share. In the UK, leftist Twitter users recently deluded themselves into believing that Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn had a chance to win the election. After Labour suffered its most crushing defeat in a century, Corbyn's Twitter crowd insisted that he'd won the argument. In the US, the Twitterati routinely direct genuine fury toward any Democrat who suggests moderation, and insist that the way to win elections is to embrace socialism and super wokeness on issues of race and gender. Twitter users should understand that their views are not as widely shared as they may believe, even among their own political allies. The Twitter bubble can be entertaining, but it's nowhere close to reality. Letting Trump court cases drag on. Why are the courts taking so long to decide cases crucial to President Trump's impeachment and chances of winning the 2020 election? Asked Barry Friedman and Dahlia Lithwick. Federal courts have proven they can act very quickly when circumstances demand it. During Watergate, the Supreme Court even came back into session in July to rule on Congress' demand for President Richard Nixon's Oval Office tapes, ruling unanimously against Nixon. During the legal battle over the 2000 presidential election, the Supreme Court moved at warp speed to award the election to George W. Bush. But now that Trump is trying to run out the clock on court cases about his financial records and his refusal to let anyone who served in his administration testify before Congress, the courts, especially the Supreme Court, seem to be in no rush. Had the courts quickly ruled on the congressional subpoena issue, the House impeachment hearings might have included witnesses whose testimony would be badly damaging to Trump. Americans might also know by now why Trump is so desperate to hide his tax returns. Are Republican-appointed judges moving so slowly on crucial Trump cases for a reason? Sometimes not resolving a case in time for relief is a decision. This is a How They See Us column from Europe. In retreat from the Mideast, Europe must wake up to the reality that the U.S. is no longer prepared to play policeman in the Middle East, said Peter Smolar in Le Monde from France. Forget the recent assassination of Iranian Major General Qassem Soleimani. That was merely a blip in the Trump administration's pullback from the volatile region. President Donald Trump believes that since the fracking revolution has slashed America's reliance on foreign oil, the U.S. has few strategic interests in the Middle East. In his view, the fight against ISIS is finished or should fall to others. Trump has proposed that NATO take responsibility for keeping the Middle East quiet, even suggesting last week that the alliance expand into Arabic lands, becoming NATO plus ME. Unlike the U.S., France doesn't have the luxury of abandoning the war against ISIS. The brutal terrorist attacks in Paris in 2015 and Nice in 2016 killed more than 200 people and proved that the jihadist group is an existential threat to our way of life. If America won't fight by our side, we will need to rouse the British and the Germans from their catastrophic torpor. The British government is already alarmed, said Tim Shipman in the Sunday Times from UK. In an interview with this paper, Defense Secretary Ben Wallace said the prospect of America withdrawing from its global role keeps him up at night. The assumption of 2010, that we were always going to be part of a U.S. coalition, Wallace said, is really just not where we are going to be. The loss of the U.S. as key partner will have dramatic repercussions, not least for the British defense budget. Right now, the U.K. and other European NATO allies rely on America to provide air cover and reconnaissance during foreign interventions. Britain will have to start preparing to fight its own wars. Don't blame Trump, said Hans Stein in Die Welt from Germany. America's isolation has been growing for years. Former President Barack Obama was more polite about it, but he, too, wanted little to do with PACs and allies. The difference is that Obama was president of the orderly retreat, while Trump presides over a disorderly retreat. And little will change if Trump loses the November presidential election. No candidate vying for the Democratic nomination dare say that America has a vital role to play as world policeman. The void left by America's gradual withdrawal is being filled by actors who are unscrupulous enough to use military force and then pretend to be conflict solvers, said Noy Press. The Turks and Russians are meddling in Syria and Libya, while the Iranians are in Iraq, Syria, and Yemen. German Chancellor Angela Merkel met with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Moscow last week to discuss these issues, and the two have already agreed that a Libyan peace conference will take place soon in Berlin. With the U.S. an unreliable partner, Germany is taking a pragmatic approach, and a new alliance is forming. Our feature article this week, the last word, is titled, The Making of Trumpism. Years before he became president, Donald Trump learned populist politics from talk radio and attention seekers like Newt Gingrich, said journalist Michael Cruz in Politico.com. His gift is in selling what he learned. Sometime soon, Donald Trump, the third president in the history of the United States to be impeached, is expected to face a trial in the Senate, charged with abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. Traced back to its roots, this is a crisis entirely of his own creation. He came across a sketchy scrap of information, a debunked piece of Russian propaganda relating to Ukraine, and he saw it as something he could use to help himself and to hurt an opponent. He latched onto it, pumped it up, and passed it along. Anyone wondering how the president could make this kind of mistake has missed something important about Trump's rise. For as long as he has been in politics, in fact for longer, he has been a ruthlessly effective practitioner of the art of parroting others' most provocative, salacious ideas. There are a lot of people that think, dot, 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 that's what I heard, dot, dot, dot. Some people even say, dot, dot, dot. His gossipy M.O. was a staple of his campaign, propelling his historic victory, but it also has driven the scandal that has consumed his presidency. I would like you to find out what happened with this whole situation with Ukraine. They say CrowdStrike, he said on the now well-known call last July with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. If what he was referencing sounded kind of like a dodgy talk radio rant, that's not an accident. It's a deliberate tactic, one that Trump was developing and exploiting from the moment he first seriously started to consider a run for the White House. In the early to middle part of the previous decade, Trump's proto-political operation was essentially a two-man team. There was Roger Stone, now a felon, and there was Stone's protege, Sam Nunberg. One of Nunberg's self-appointed tasks was to help Trump understand what the masses on the right really wanted. And one way he did that was by listening to Mark Levin's increasingly popular radio show. The people who were tuning in most intently to Levin, Nunberg thought, were the people most likely to vote for Trump if he launched an actual bid. Donald Trump, Nunberg told me, meaning his candidacy, meaning his victory, would never have happened without Mark Levin. Nunberg's frequent emails to Trump, sent via an assistant in Trump's office, were accounts of the many grievances that animated Levin and his listeners. Union members resented union leaders. The Republican rank and file loathed Republican elites. Amnesty for immigrants, an absolute no-go. Trump, Nunberg stressed when we talked, didn't want to be told what to say. But Nunberg nonetheless made his pitch for him as an insurgent outsider. This is all marketing, and you're a great product in a new type of market, he said he told Trump. Help me help you sell gold to those people that normally buy gold. Trump started listening to the show. He would call me up sometimes, Nunberg recalled. Oh, did you just hear what Levin said? For the better part of the past half century, Trump has extracted from an array of similar sources, from the New York Post's dishy Page Six, to the toxicity of Twitter, to far-right websites and lowbrow TV, a knack for knowing what people want. Not all people, but many people. And not what they say they want, but what they really want. Ostentatious and aspirational glitz, plain talk to the point of crude talk, conflict, a creature of feel, as the late strategist Pat Caddell described him to me in 2018, a visceral stimulus creature. Trump could repackage what he took in and sell it back to the hoi polloi. In 2010, for example, he recognized a lightning rod issue, torquing emotions, and jumped right in, gleaning buzz for himself with his offer to purchase the site of the so-called Ground Zero Mosque, which alerted him to the potency of anti-Obama birtherism, which paved the way for his anger-girded, fear-mongering presidential candidacy. Trump is in this way less a thinker and more a megaphone, an amplifier of the ideas of others, the value of those ideas in his mind based not on veracity so much as utility. Which is another way of saying he's not so much a leader as he is a follower, perhaps the ultimate follower. Trump is the follower of the free world. Donald was never a CEO. He was a brand manager. You know, how do I appeal to the masses? Former Trump publicist Alan Marcus told me recently. It's like Elmer Gantry. It's the carnival barker. It's what every pitchman has always done. Tell the people what they want to hear. Taking the information he wants or needs, former Trump casino exec Jack O'Donnell said, whether it's true or not, former Trump Organization exec Barbara Ress said, taking it in, sending it out over and over again and again. Starting in the 1970s, Donald Trump learned how to fight dirty and win from his antagonistic attorney and mentor, Roy Kahn. In the 80s, he learned from Stone and from watching George Steinbrenner, Ed Koch, and Ronald Reagan, too. Steinbrenner, the bombastic owner of the New York Yankees, led as a loner. His secretary frequently could be heard saying, Mr. Steinbrenner, Trump on line two. Koch won three times as the mayor of New York with an uncomplicated formula for success. Get attention to get votes. And you can only do that, he once said, by being bigger than life. It's theatrics. Reagan spent the decade blurring the lines between politics and entertainment, wondering at times how anybody could be an effective president without having been an actor first. In the 90s, Trump learned from watching Ross Perot run for president and lose, and Jesse Ventura run for governor of Minnesota and win. The nutty billionaire and the wrestler, he called them, according to Stone. He watched Newt Gingrich weaponize words in the political arena in a new and virulent manner, labeling Democrats traitors and sick and urging his fellow Republicans to do the same. And Trump in 2011 seized on what people, some people, misguided, bigoted, or both, thought about the country's first black president. The birtherism campaign he began to wage was the distillation of his scattershot but resolute education as the kibitzer, the gossip hound, the insurgent outsider, the nascent politician, the feeder off the fever swamps, the follower. I'm starting to wonder myself whether or not he was born in this country, he said on Fox News in March of that year. He doesn't have a birth certificate, he told talker Laura Ingraham 2 days later. Somebody told me. A lot of people do not think it was an authentic certificate, he said on CNN in 2012, long after the White House released Obama's long-form birth certificate. Was it a birth certificate? You tell me, he told ABC News in 2013. Some people say that was not his birth certificate. That same year, Nunberg arranged for Trump to make his Levin show debut. In addition to shilling for the upcoming season of The Celebrity Apprentice, Trace Adkins, LaToya Jackson, Dennis Rodman, Trump delivered to Levin's listeners what they wanted, which essentially was Levin's ideas, studiously collected by Nunberg, consumed by Trump, and regurgitated back to the host. If the Republicans are going to win, Trump said, they're going to have to break away from the Karl Roves of the world and, frankly, get more involved, you know. The Tea Party, these people are great. He landed especially hard on immigration and any notions of amnesty for undocumented immigrants. Immigration, Trump said, will be the next thing, based on what I'm watching. Trump and Levin wrapped up by exchanging compliments. I'm extremely impressed with what you're doing, Levin said. You just have a great show, Trump said. I'm always listening. This ear to the proverbial ground political ramp-up wasn't limited to Levin and talk radio. It was around this time as well that Trump began to give more and more talks on the pre-presidential hustings, GOP chicken dinners, in places like Iowa and New Hampshire. He talked to Pat Caddell about what he was picking up on the trail. He would put forth his position or his feelings, and he would judge the level of response to it, and that helped him organize, I suppose to whatever degree it was organized, his views about issues, Caddell told me in 2018. Things he said that didn't go over disappeared. Things that did stayed. Twitter, too, increasingly served a similar purpose. He glommed onto it like it was an oxygen source, Caddell explained, and he would tweet what he believed, and people would retweet or answer or whatever, and it was a kind of his ongoing focus group. He loved it, Nunberg said. He doesn't trust the political people who do the focus groups. Instead, what are we getting the most retweets on? A month into the presidential campaign, after the Vietnam-avoiding Trump insulted Senator John McCain by saying he was not a war hero and that he liked people who weren't captured, he refused to apologize. Nunberg told Trump it was going to help him. He said, "Why?" Nunberg said. And I said, "Because our people despise John McCain. They despise the fact that McCain hides behind his military record to blank on Republicans, and you can't criticize him on anything because of his military record." Talk radio led the way. Trump followed. "As president, Trump has stuck to that gossip kind of mentality," said O'Donnell, the casino exec. "Trump has continued to mine Twitter, plucking what he wants, very comfortable with half-thoughts, always looking for tidbits of information that he can use to his advantage. He sees the ones that are the most popular. Former Fox News anchor Eric Bolling, identified by Time as someone who speaks regularly to Trump, told the magazine in June 2018, "and getting the most of the zeitgeist, most attention on social media." And then, the last and most important piece of this, by now almost rote process, he repeats it, Bolling said. "For as long as he's occupied the Oval Office, Trump's been thinking about Ukraine." Ukraine, Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina said a couple of months back, has always been problematic from day one. He's heard a lot about Ukraine from a lot of people. He's heard about it, according to reports, from Rudy Giuliani, from his favored right-wing media outlets, from Vladimir Putin. He started spreading it almost immediately. "I heard it's owned by a very rich Ukrainian," he said of CrowdStrike, incorrectly, in an interview with the Associated Press in April 2017. "That's what I heard." Officials have insisted to the president that CrowdStrike conspiracy theory is just that. He has not heeded their counsel. It's what led to the call with Ukraine's Zelensky, that led to the series of events that led to his impeachment. "The server," Trump said. "They say Ukraine has it." It's combustible because Trump's only looking for news stories and information that suit his persona, that build his persona up, presidential historian Douglas Brinkley told me last week. And by doing that, he is following the trolls down an ugly path. If Trump began his political ascent as a follower, cannily co-opting ideas that resonated with a certain segment of the electorate, in doing so, he clearly has proceeded to forge a following of his own. He has become a leader of those who are willing to be led in this way, solidifying lockstep support from the agenda-setting base of his party, as well as its kingpins and figureheads who parrot him the way he once did Levin. The result? A crescendoing feedback loop in which followers are leaders and leaders are followers, perpetuating ideas based on what works rather than what's real. One of the sacred principles in U.S. history has been that presidents are supposed to tell the public the truth, Brinkley said. So this is a new kind of Republican that refuses to ever admit culpability or a mistake and is willing to destroy not just institutions, but fact-based thinking, empirical thinking. Trump? He doesn't care whether it's true or not true, whether it destroys somebody or not. There's no morality in it. It's just a strange, weird bit of information, and it helps me, and I'm going to propagate it. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Politico magazine. We're on the Talking Points page. We'll start with an article entitled "Environmental Regulation, a Major Rollback." President Trump is proposing stark changes to the nation's oldest and most established environmental law, said Lisa Friedman in the New York Times. In an escalation of his three-year effort to roll back clean air and water protection, the president plans to revise a 50-year-old National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA, to narrow the range of infrastructure projects that require an environmental impact statement for approval. Such assessments offer federal regulators detailed analyses of the environmental consequences of building a given bridge, pipeline, highway, or power plant in deciding whether to give it a thumbs up. The revision would also set hard deadlines of 1 year to complete reviews of smaller projects and 2 years for larger ones. The new regulation, which requires a 60-day comment period before going into effect, will likely be challenged in court. Trump calls it a necessary step to quicken an outrageously slow process. The administration's proposed improvements are long overdue, said Tom Donahue and Sean McGarvey in TheHill.com. Too often, NEPA has resulted in permitting paralysis that left critical infrastructure projects languishing on the drawing board. The expansion of an airport runway in Taos, New Mexico, was delayed more than 20 years due to NEPA reviews. In Grand Haven, Michigan, a two-lane roadway and bridge were stalled by 16 years. Very often it takes longer to get the permits for a project than to actually build it. Yes, research has shown that the average impact statement took 4.5 years to complete between 2010 and 2017. But considering the facts, takes time, and it's surely preferable to greenlighting a project that could infringe on a critical wildlife habitat, harm water resources, or destroy culturally sensitive areas. Do we want to return to the pre-regulatory era when the heavily polluted Cuyahoga River in Ohio caught fire? Instead of wrecking this key pillar of environmental protection, Trump should fight for sufficient funds to hire enough employees to finish reviews in a timely fashion. Most Americans want a sensible middle ground on regulations, said Robert Samuelson in the Washington Post. The economy shouldn't be paralyzed by regulatory overkill, but broad support remains for sensible regulation of the environment. Wall Street, pharmaceuticals, and cars. Free market forces don't always produce results in the public's best interest. Bloomberg and Steyer, bottomless spenders. Two billionaires are trying to buy the Democratic presidential nomination, said Libby Watson in NewRepublic.com, and their strategy of pulverizing the airwaves with advertisements is working. Michael Bloomberg and Tom Steyer have self-financed a combined $270 million in TV ads, while the next six candidates have collectively spent $40 million on TV to date. Bloomberg, the eighth wealthiest American, estimated net worth $58 billion, and former New York City mayor, is flooding the Super Tuesday primary states with ads and has hired a staggering 1,000 staffers across 33 states, partly by offering above-market salaries. Polls now show Steyer, a former hedge fund manager with zero experience in public office, surging into second place in South Carolina and third in Nevada. The wealthy already have far too much influence in our country, said Nell Abernathy in USA Today. Bloomberg and Steyer are shamelessly writing blank checks to drown out competition in a very undemocratic way. Liberals may complain now, said John Ellis in WashingtonPost.com, but they will learn to love Bloomberg's wallet. In just 2 months, he spent an astronomical amount, more than triple what President Trump spent of his own funds in 2016, including $10 million for a 60-second Super Bowl ad. He might spend $1 billion or even $2 billion on the race, or several times what Trump and the GOP will, and he says he'll keep spending to defeat Trump even if someone else gets the nomination. Numbers like that upend every model of presidential races. Bloomberg also appeals to moderate, pragmatic voters looking for someone who can beat Trump. Down-ballot Democrats would also be boosted by Bloomberg-funded organizing, voter registration drives, and issues advertising. He might not be the most exciting candidate, but by Super Tuesday, he'll look like Brad Pitt. Neither billionaire is likely to win the nomination, said Eric Levitz in NYMag.com. What makes their campaigns so concerning, however, is their rationality. Even if they fail to win a single delegate, they're demonstrating that billionaires can influence public opinion through paid messaging alone. Democrats, delighted by Bloomberg's willingness to spend whatever it takes to rid the country of Trump, should remember that the typical billionaire donor is well to be to Bloomberg's right. The super rich will be watching closely to see what a lot of money can buy. And a couple short notes. About half of the top grossing concert tours in North America last year were led by artists who were 60 or older, according to the trade publication Pollstar. The top three slots were held by artists in their 70s, the Rolling Stones, Elton John, and Bob Seger. Others included Paul McCartney, Billy Joel, Cher, and Fleetwood Mac. Last year was the second hottest year on record, and it trailed the hottest 2016 by only a tenth of a degree Fahrenheit. There was above average warming in most regions, with exceptional warming in the Arctic, Europe, Southern Africa, and Australia. The five past years have been the five warmest on record. And we'll finish with a quote from Isaac Asimov, who says, "Science gathers knowledge faster than society gathers wisdom." And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they pride themselves on providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.